Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and today we're talking about our national compulsion to consume movies and TV shows that are just a fucking bummer. Now, depending on how old you were when, I guess, The Sopranos started, this might be all you know, but back in the 90s, TV was just dessert. It was completely unburdened by expectations that it would be anything besides witty people and indie pop rock soundtracks spoon-fed to us in our living rooms. Just cake and more cake. Our parents told us TV was bad for us, and that made sense because you could actually feel yourself getting stupider when you were watching, like, TV in the 90s. Literally everything was more productive because at least sleeping made you less tired. Smash cut to 2014, and I watch my favorite TV shows like I'm taking medicine. There's an episode of Game of Thrones a few months back that was like a national tragedy. Dan references it in our conversation. It involved blood coming from the eye sockets of a beloved character. Swaim, Michael Swaim, my occasional co-host, just quit on Game of Thrones right there. And then a few days ago, the most recent episode of The Leftovers just broke Daniel O'Brien's spirit. And he was mentioning this to us in the office, and I had felt like that for a while. I felt like the thing that used to feed me Saturday morning cartoons had become this treadmill of emotional and intellectual punishment. So that's what we're talking about today, because it's not just TV. Some of our favorite directors also got really bleak, too. We're going to spend a lot of the conversation talking about the Coen brothers, but Paul Thomas Anderson went from movies like Boogie Nights, where the surrogate families redeem one another at the end, to There Will Be Blood, in which his greatest character ends the movie by telling his son that he's a bastard and then beating Paul Dano to death with a bowling pin. We're going to ask if this darkening of pop culture has something foreboding to do with us. Advance warning, there are going to be more than a few moments that sound like old man, these days are different than my days, and that's bad because I say so logic. I do recognize how ass backwards that logic is if you're just picking us up. Our entire first episode was devoted to mocking that impulse in a high sissy voice. Oh, look at me. I'm the greatest generation. Women and black people are the worst. I don't do the whole first episode in that voice, but us oldsters just happen to be the ones who are cursed to notice when things change all of a sudden, and sometimes it's worthwhile to ask why that change is happening. If the music section infuriates you, please stick around to the end. I want to talk a little bit more about what we're talking about there. All right, here's our conversation back at the end for some final thoughts and footnotes. I got the rhetoric, the better half, a good percentage, this is meta math. Too futuristic to accept the past, that's why you'll never be effective in the present. I'm in love with my position, you in love with your position. All right, I am joined by occasional co-host Michael Swaim.
I'm out of sound effects to do to introduce myself. I'm sorry.
Ooh, get out of here.
That's a good one.
And Daniel O'Brien.
No title.
No title. Columnists, you have so many titles. It's like, yeah, introducing.
Titles just beget more titles anyway. I think the last time I got promotion, I was just given land as well.
Some of them were legally obliged by the state to inform people of. So.
Yeah, right.
But we'll get to that at the end.
Is this the first time you two have been on a podcast together?
It is.
Maybe,
indeed.
Yeah.
Wow.
Undermining popular fan theory that we're the same person.
You did that Star Wars one, right? That was us?
Yeah, you guys were there together.
You talking about Star Wars?
I'm unfamiliar with Star Wars.
But Cody was such a chatterbox that...
Yeah, Star Wars conversation in my mind, Cody is saying all the points and we're just nodding.
He was actually, because we said Star Wars, another Cody was just born now every yeah. time we talk about it.
So we're doing kind of a state of the pop culture union, maybe, talking about sort of general trends that we've noticed as people who spend too much time thinking about pop culture. And this was kind of spawned by something that Dan was observing about TV in general.
Yeah, TV has gotten really bleak to me. I know there are still comedies out there, but as far as shows that are well written, well acted, well produced, well shot and everything, it seems like the shorthand for those kind of HBO's big drama shows is that they need to be wildly bleak and depressing. This is born out of The Leftovers, which is a new HBO show, and how it's a really well-made show. There are some phenomenal actors in it. It's just so depressing, and it's so bleak and nihilistic. I don't even know what it would be. It's the very first episode, and this podcast will contain spoilers, everyone. We already know that the show is a world where 2% of the population disappears, and everyone's just trying to cope with that. And in the first episode, there's a scene of a 15-year-old girl crying on a bed while she chokes another boy while he masturbates. This is a scene that they put in this show, and it's just
to like introduce you to the
world. Welcome to this world. The last episode that they showed, the priest character, who is, you know, the closest thing to good that we've seen so far, because his church is struggling, but he's still giving out free baptisms because he's a good guy that way, and he's running out of money to keep his church, and some other company wants to buy it. And in this episode, he gets the shit kicked out of him twice by two completely different people, has a rock thrown in his head, compromises all of his morals to save his church, and then by the end of the episode, does not save it. Like, gets enough money, randomly through an act of God, he goes to a casino, puts $20,000 on red 3 times in a row, and gets the money that he needs to save his church. Like, good, there's some kind of goodness in this world. Then a guy beats the shit out of him and takes his money. And then he rallies and gets his money back. And you're like, good, there's goodness in this world. Then someone throws a rock at him and knocks him unconscious. And then he wakes up in the hospital and sprints over to the bank to stop them from foreclosing on his church. And the guy's like, oh no, you've been in a coma for like 3 days. We sold away you were in that coma after that guy threw a rock at you, after that stranger pelted you with a boulder.
Cause God told us to.
Yeah, end of the episode, that's it. And
I'm wearing some of your clothes right now.
Yeah. I've wondered, or I've said to many of the Cracked gang, am I growing up? Oh God, like, is my career over? Because I'm starting to feel that it is the media and not just me. But yeah, it's everything. I felt that way about True Detective, fabulous show, everyone doing a great job. So depressing, I almost couldn't keep watching it. I have my own theory of like tracing it back to different pop culture branches that have been going, but I feel like this one, or at least if we're sticking in the HBO vein, it's really good to talk about The Wire as introducing the idea of disappointment as the trope. For me, The Wire was the first show that in a big way seemed to hit over and over that, oh, you know what's unique about this show? You get all your hopes up and you see who's good and bad and you see what should happen karmically, and then it doesn't happen because the fucking system, man. Isn't that disappointing? And that was like the first show for me where I enjoyed the feeling of being disappointed.
Yeah.
Like, rather than I watch a comedy to laugh, I watch a drama to cry, I was like, oh, I'm watching this to feel that feeling of having my hopes dashed. But now they're so good at it that I resent it. Like,
right.
I recently, through no fault of the show, I don't think I can watch Game of Thrones anymore. It's too upsetting to me because I'm a pussy, apparently.
Yeah, that's true. I have two things to say about The Wire, though, because even The Wire is, I do think its message is important, and that should exist in fiction. Like, I always like what Coen brothers do, where they don't often have a grand point to their movies, and that is the point. Like, No Country for
Old Men. My main thing's all about Coen brothers. Keep going.
No Country for Old Men is very much just a portrait. Like, this is a thing that just happens. The good guys don't win. The bad guys don't really get punished. This is just a snapshot. Doesn't really have too much meaning. Sometimes life is like that. I think that's an important message. I just think it's too pervasive right now, and it's sort of really easy to do. We've made it very easy to do that. And you brought up The Wire. I would say even The Wire had fun, though.
Oh, yeah.
Leftovers,
oh,
there's no fun. Wire, you got, you're laughing at Omar, you're always laughing at Bubbles, or with Bubbles,
and Marlo? That guy's a riot.
Marlo, that knee slapper.
And even True Detective at the very end has a little, like, I guess everything's fine. I'm actually happy. It's okay.
That is. So people have been doing some really great Matthew McConaughey impressions.
I thought I'd go a different way.
No.
Yeah. My shirt is off, though.
I do wonder if this is something that you started hearing around the time of The Wire was that, well, this is the great American novel. This is what we have instead of Dickens.
Gatsby.
And yeah, we have these TV shows, and TV shows are now taking the place of where our parents used to read novels in their downtime to get a snapshot of how cities fuck people up and, you know, systemic rot and decay. Now
TV has kind of stepped up to that cultural mantle because they had to, because nobody reads anymore. Nobody reads novels anymore. And so I think Game of Thrones is a good example. That's one that I'm now starting to dread. It's something about Sunday nights that we just yeah. want to dread our Sunday yeah. nights. But
yeah. dovetails really well into hating Monday morning.
Right. Yeah. But I think one of the things that works so well about Game of Thrones is that it's based on a novel and has mm-hmm. those tracks laid for it. So you know where it's going.
Although not having read the novel, sorry to interrupt, but what I understand, one of the few things they diverged in was to turn like a questionable sexual liaison into explicit rape by a corpse, which is like, to me, the same impulse of like, could we make it darker? Like, there's right. some executive at HBO going like, it could be a little darker though,
well,
right?
Well, I do think that, I mean, it's telling that all the shows that were like, now that's greatest TV show ever, are all incredibly fucking Russian novel, dark, yeah, yeah. just nothing but human misery. And I think it's either, you could say, well, it's TV kind of overcompensating for the fact that they used to be just like episodic Cheers or whatever.
Oh, but Cheers was so good.
Oh, Cheers was great, but it was happy and unlike real life. And TV around the time of The Sopranos was like, oh, we can be this other thing. We can tell these like really gritty stories and but it's working, so I don't think we can just say, oh, TV's just trying too hard.
No, it's been working, but I think it's really interesting. I think you're absolutely right, and I think it's a phase that may pass eventually because it's like TV really trying to prove itself because it's time for it to do that in the way that like I feel a lot of people throughout my life, or I've had this conversation a lot, where I think people used to equate a movie with a book. I mean, because so many books are adapted into movies, obviously, but when you think about the amount of content in a movie versus a TV show is much more in line with a book. An episode of TV is about how long it takes to read a chapter of a story that would go however long. Mm-hmm. And I think as movies have sort of become this action ride thing and abdicated the role of like being serious and important, these are all generalizations, of course, there's great movies coming out, but I feel like TV feels like it has to prove, it's like, we're more movies than movies ever were. It's okay, you didn't lose movies.
I also think that there is something to the fact that we need darkness. We need our art to have darkness in it, and since we have apparently stopped reading, like,
I thought we read more words on average, but they're all online.
Right, they're all online, or they're, and
they're emails.
The novels we're reading now aren't gritty literature, right. So
gritterature,
of course.
Right, we look to television for that, but I was thinking about Maleficent because that seemed like a very dark movie. I was like, wow, that's proof we're getting darker because now Disney's making movies about the villain. But when you look at past versions of the Sleeping Beauty fairy tale, in the 1700s, Prince Charming just rapes her in her sleep and she wakes up and she's right. pregnant. Or, yeah. you know, in an earlier version, she wakes up, but then there's like this big cannibalistic orgy. Yeah. We've always had this darkness. It's just like it
moves
comes
around
out in
like
different,
yeah. yeah, it hangs around in different areas. Yeah, it's weird. Like in the episode where you and Jason talked about Apocalypse Obsession, I thought it was really interesting that if you go back in time and in every era, some segment of the population was into dark shit and saying the world's gonna end soon. It just moves around.
Yeah. I guess I'm just not. When I brought this up with friends, I want shows that aren't so bleak and horrible that are also good. They'll bring up like, oh, Bob's Burgers is a fine show, and like New Girl will come back. I guess I want something as that can be as light as, like even Breaking Bad was lighter. It always had Walt being kind of goofy, Ned Flanders, and Jesse right. was generally very funny, and Saul Goodman was good. And then the last season was the darkest, bleakest, like Jesse is this bruised and abused slave who almost doesn't say a word the last few episodes. Walt is chasing his wife around the house, and she's got a knife, and the baby is screaming. He kidnaps his baby. Saul Goodman is just broken and depressed, and it's a shift of the show, a shift from the slightly lighter stuff of the first few seasons to just bombarding you with sadness and misery. And oh, guess what? His cancer's back, too.
Right. That did seem, I was like, oh, this is part of some gambit he's doing because not everything could go this wrong at once. But
oh,
yeah.
like he shaved his head and it was all
right.
Clear, yeah.
It was like, no, cancer's back because that's how
it's
life
not going
is
to,
at its worst.
It's not
going
to play into anything. That's not how I die or anything. You should know that I'm in pain. Also.
Right. Just know that the last few months of my life were just a little bit shittier than you might have thought. I do think that there's also something with the anti-hero. I think that to sustain our attention for any prolonged TV show or anything, or, you know, even movies to a certain extent, we need to have an anti-hero. We can't just have a straightforward hero anymore, because that makes total sense to me given where we are in history. Like, we've kind of woken up from history and, like, come to the conclusion that, you know, we're kind of the bad guys in a lot of ways.
As we are the good guys, history's a bunch of stuff and you could always go back and see, read more.
Yeah. But, like, the Planet of the Apes movies are humanity are the bad guys. Yeah, like, yeah. You're rooting against humanity. And, like, I feel like that is part of what drives these shows to be, like, the great TV shows and the great statements from popular culture on, like, who we are. Is it's always a white male anti-hero.
Right. This could be a stretch, but this is now getting into, like, just call me conspiracy theorist if you want. I always have felt like there is a not negligible connection between the idea that news is so pervasive now, and there's studies and stuff, just that people are more worried now about global things, that, you know, the village has expanded, the world is smaller, you have more to worry about. And we're also the generation raised knowing that global warming's our fault. And, like, I feel that there is a deep need for us to explicate our guilt by saying, like, I know we're the bad guys. I love it. I cheer for the apes to kill us. It's fine. I think in a way we want to cop to stuff and admit stuff. But I also think it's warping, because news makes you more worried than you should be, or it makes you think more negatively than you could.
But also, I think specifically because of the news, because this was part of my theory too, when I look at the bleakness, I think, I mean, writers live in the same world that I do, and the world that I live in is not tremendous right now, and that's just sort of infecting their writing. But to me, that means, because things are so bad, that means you have even more of an obligation to make fiction that is optimistic. Who's even doing that right now?
Yeah.
Looking at the world and really making a solid case in favor of optimism and
rather than the Bob's Burgers point is really good. It's a great show, but you mean in the way that even though Game of Thrones is a fantasy, it's trying as hard as it can for verisimilitude. Like, it's trying to convince you that if there were magic and dragons and stuff, this is how it would really happen, and this is, like, real or whatever. You want something that feels like happy things happen and it's real, like it could happen.
Right.
Like, the world might be a good place. Which they just seem on the decline right now. Mm-hmm.
Parks and Rec is the closest thing to, like, an optimistic show.
Right, I love that she's, like, rewarded for working hard and being cheerful. That
she is
great.
But that last season, if not for the last episode, would have just been a nightmare. That was almost too much for me, because she had seen the realization of a lifelong dream of wanting to be an actual public official, and everything went to shit. Everyone hated her. They turned on her. None of the stuff that she wanted to do got through. She was eventually removed from office.
Right.
And if they didn't do a time jump at the end of the season that's like, look, things are better for her now, I would have just been sad. Just turned all the lights off and been sad with nothing to watch. Like, I think about the phrase water cooler shows, that you'd watch Seinfeld and the next day talk with all your buddies at the water cooler at work. And just how miserable that Far Side cartoon of our Monday morning water coolers would be. When it's like, oh, did you watch Sunday? Yeah, I'm really sad.
Yeah, that's happened so many times to us.
I called
my
mom to make sure she was okay, and now I don't know.
Yeah.
How we're going to get back from that episode of Mad Men.
Right. Even with comedy, I do feel like Sam was right. He was the bartender who kind of knew stuff, and he had, like, had his battles, but he was a good guy who, like, kind of had a point of view that was generally in the right. Seinfeld even was right about little kind of stupid stuff, and they tried to, at the end, like, turn him and be like, oh, we were jerks all along. But I do think that the reason that a lot of people enjoyed that was that they were kind of identifying with...
They shared those pet peeves. And as much as Seinfeld is a show about... supposed to be a show about four assholes, no, it's not. Not by our standards. Always Sunny is a show about four assholes.
Right.
Like Seinfeld, Jerry Seinfeld with his jeans and his button-ass, he looks like such a nice guy today when you watch that show.
And
you're like, oh, he just dumped a girl. That's not that big a deal.
Yeah. And like the humor came from like the Banya characters or the Bryan Cranston as the anti-dentite dentist. But comparing that to The Office and Parks and Rec, where the character is always sort of a deluded, they're not right. The joke is that their point of view is off. There's something that they don't understand about themselves and the world around them. There's still like a guiltiness at the core of, I think, a lot of our comedy. Yeah.
Comedies always have that undertone, but it is striking to me in Modern Family, which I would say is trying to be very optimistic and also trying to pretend that it's real or more grounded than, what, Rick and Morty or whatever. But I am always struck by how much the husband and wife hate each other.
Yeah.
The things they say to each other behind each other's backs, you couldn't do in real life, and people would be like, are there serious problems in your marriage? Is that a... You really hold him in that much contempt? We just released an article about, or are going to, about movie rules that good directors know they can get away with. Like, yes, it's a plot hole, but the audience will not notice because we accept it all the time. And I think one of the things we accept all the time in TV comedy is at the end, if there's the right music and they say, but of course we're family and we love each other, you're like, oh, okay. I'm trying to think of something that the most recent thing that was fairly popular and also just incredibly life-affirming and uplifting. 12 Years a Slave ended happily and was like life-affirming, but it's horrifying the whole
right.
time.
We couldn't even end Lincoln on the part where slavery ends. We couldn't even end Lincoln. We all know that eventually Abraham Lincoln gets shot in the head in the theater. We spend that whole movie of everyone trying to hustle to get these votes to push
right,
through.
Right, that's the end of the arc. You
right,
could stop
the arc
there.
Is done.
Well, like, off
okay,
to
good.
The theater then.
We're wrapped up. It's 2.5 hours. That's short for Steven Spielberg. Oh, he's going to the theater?
Oh, boy.
You're going to show his body? Yeah. Okay. Great. Is his wife crying? Good. Oh, credits? Good. Good. Fine. Thank you. Thanks for that.
I'm a fan of the theory that movies are like sort of cultural dreams. And like one of my recurring dreams, and I just started hearing other people say that they've had this recurring dream, is the dream that you've committed murder. You don't see yourself having done
I've had
it,
that a couple times. But you like, wait, or I've even woken up and for a few minutes I'm like, I have to get away with it. Like, right. What do I do to get away with it?
Yeah. I just wonder if we're guiltier than, like, past iterations of humanity. Like, we feel guiltier. We should. We know more about all
I think
the...
it would be natural if you, in general, are more educated in human history. It would be natural to feel guiltier.
Right.
Like, I don't know, because that is kind of the way it is.
I do wonder if that's something that's being reflected now more than ever, or if we're just...
We were talking about Cheers earlier, and I was just reading this interview with one of the writers for Cheers that was talking about they wanted to do an episode about AIDS, and they were thinking very realistically, our main character is a man who is incredibly sexually active right now in this world. Doesn't that mean we have to do an episode about AIDS? Shouldn't we address a thing that would very clearly be impacting this guy's life? And they sat on that, one of the writers said, everyone knows about AIDS. Someone give me a reason why for 30 minutes on Thursday night they need to be reminded of it. Give me a good reason.
Why like, is Cheers the PSA?
Yeah, and they're
why
like, you know what, you're right, they don't need to, this is 30 minutes when they don't need to be thinking about that. Let's just do a story where Cliff pulls a gun. I don't know, I haven't yeah. seen it.
You haven't watched a lot of Cheers lately. Yeah.
And that's super interesting for them because that was occasionally a very dark show. There was that mm-hmm. scene where Sam and Diane just slapped the crap out of each other.
Yeah.
That was like hugely impactful to me as a kid when I saw
no,
it.
No, I remember it well.
She slaps him. And he immediately hits her right back.
And you're like, whoa.
And the audience,
TV
no one's
rules.
Laughing. Yeah, 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 that's a thing that you haven't seen before. Yeah. But they still, at the end of the day, recognize the value in being optimistic and not mm-hmm. shoving bleakness and reminding everyone that AIDS is a thing.
Yeah. While showing domestic violence, like in Stark, yeah, yeah. like showing it actually happen. I think that's an interesting sign of like how different values
right.
are.
I don't feel like there's anyone on the writing staff of Game of Thrones that is saying, why do we need to remind people about rape and torture? Let's just do a yeah. standalone where like Arya makes a friend and they hang out.
Man,
or whatever.
I would love a really well written short episode where Arya makes a legitimate friend.
Knowing where the books go
instead of just sweet roll kids.
Hey guys, we've got a new partner sponsoring this week's episode, Automatic, which is your smart driving assistant on your smartphone. Automatic connects your car and smartphone and helps you make small changes in your driving habits that can lead to huge savings on gas over time. Basically, you'll end up saving hundreds on gas. You'll never forget where you parked. You can diagnose your engine light automatically, you know, when the little check engine light comes on, it'll be like, yo, that's nothing to worry about. And also, it can help in a serious crash. I know there's that OnStar Assist program that is, I think, people end up paying a lot of extra money for. And this will do that for you. It's available on iPhone and Android and ships in 2 business days. Visit automatic.com/order. And if you use the promo code CRACKED, you're going to get 20% off. It usually costs $99.95, and it's just $80, guys. And ships in 2 business days, 45-day return policy, and the shipping's free. So no reason not to try it. So give it a try. Automatic is your smart driving assistant on your smartphone.
Well, this reminds me a bit of that conversation we were having at Smith House the other night about...
Smith House, great bar on Santa Monica Boulevard.
Big sponsor of the show. We're getting a lot of dollars out of that shout out. But about that, I think one of the most often taken for granted underlying themes of 99% of all movies and TV shows and books ever made, in English at least, is that God exists. And that's weird to say because there's many people who would say, well, I don't know about that, or I'm agnostic, or that didn't inform my story. But every story is based on the basic supposition that good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people, and if they don't, that's unfair. That just always really interests me how that, even a cheesy action movie, that is at play. It's not exactly how real life is. It assumes karma is true.
When you say God exists, you're not saying this...
I'm not being as controversial as I sound.
Judeo-Christian Muslim God, but the thing that we were talking about at Smith House, a fantastic bar with great food.
Lobster mac to die
for. What
the
fuck is going on right now, guys? Nobody lives in L.A. listens to our show.
This study that I read recently was saying that there's a lot of arguments we had that atheists don't really exist because this idea of some kind of metaphysical presence that governs things is so deeply ingrained in us from jump and from culture that it's impossible to expunge it. They might not think God as described by the Bible or the idea of even a person, but most people still have this idea that there's some kind of balance and there's some kind of justice or karma, whatever it is that you... in the back of your mind, acknowledge that is out there and bigger than you. That is this idea.
Right. And I feel like there's something to be said for that being part of why we innately want to imbibe stories constantly. Both that it is fun to learn something we don't know or be surprised by the events of the movie, but just as much, it's the new tribal ritual to have everyone chant and re-imbibe the stuff that we all believe is true, which is that humans are basically good and society can keep going and it's all going to hold together. Because, like, yeah, if you work hard and blah, 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 maybe your best friend will die heroically, but, like, you get the girl and the money and it's all fine.
Yeah.
Right. And fiction tells us that even if your best friend does die, there was some kind of reason for it. Like, he was supposed to advance the
something.
Plot of your
yeah,
life.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I find Game of Thrones' bleakness easier to suffer, is because I feel like it is explicitly doing that. Most scenes and most traumatic events in those books are like drawn from history. So when you were talking about not necessarily a Judeo-Christian, but like sort of a karmic God, mm-hmm. I immediately thought of True Lies for some reason. The part where the machine gun falls and mm-hmm. is just like tumbling down the steps and it shoots all the bad guys.
Yeah.
And did the wife drop it?
Probably.
Yeah.
If memory serves, I believe that movie came out 20 years ago this month.
Yeah, that's probably true.
July 15th, 1994.
Jesus,
God, I'm so great.
Daniel.
That's really weird.
That's
man.
Really frightening.
But that would not have made sense at the time if the bad guy had done that and taken out a bunch of the good guys. It was like sort of a riff on the morality of action movies.
That is interesting because, yeah, if a machine gun fell and it coincidentally killed 3 of the main characters, you would just be like, that's so unlikely. What right. a fucking cop-out. But it's totally fine if it kills 12 faceless villains.
Right.
And you could be like, that could happen. I mean, my belief is suspended.
Guns right. fire all the time yeah. for no reason.
And I think in one of our personal experience articles, anything I know, I assume was in an article, but some interview I read with some guy who was part of a police regime in a very oppressive state was like, it's really crazy and it makes you feel like there is no God. That like someone can fire a machine gun into a crowd and kill no one, and someone can do that same thing tomorrow and kill 30 people. Like, it's very, very mm-hmm. randomized where bullets go, which we know, but not in movies. The good guys have an aura of bullets missing them more, mm-hmm. and we're all okay with that. Not only are we okay with it, I think we want to keep buying into it because we would like to believe that if a really bad guy was shooting at us and we were shooting back, we're more likely to hit him than right. he is to hit us.
I believe that firmly.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You saw Planet of the Apes. Were you as shocked as I was at what good shots all of those apes were?
The first time they pick up guns.
Pick up a gun?
Yeah. Well, they're super smart because they're reverse Alzheimer's apes. So.
Sure.
Right.
Where do humans fall on the reverse Alzheimer's
apes? Well, it's, if you don't have Alzheimer's, if you're not a crack shot, that means you have some early onset Alzheimer's.
Oh, okay.
So just,
okay.
You should go to a gun range and have that checked out.
Sure.
Well, I think this dovetails nicely into the only remaining point I have written down, and then we'll be in uncharted territory. But I wanted to bring us back to the Coen brothers only briefly, because I think it's worth, like, celebrating or blaming them, or I'm wrong because I am young and I'm not thinking of someone earlier, but I feel like they're the first directors that eased the mainstream popular culture from a movie that has a karmic undertone to a nihilist movie. And now they almost only do nihilist movies, and everyone's like okay with it. And I think in some ways people may have not noticed, but like if you look at The Hudsucker Proxy or Fargo, Miller's Crossing, Raising Arizona, their early stuff, the most egregious is Hudsucker Proxy has an angel come down and stop something bad from happening just right. Because it would be wrong for the hero to fail. It's like just crazy to contrast that with No Country for Old Men, which to me was the first movie where I was like shocked and offended by bleakness. I was like, you can't just have it be anything can happen and no one is safe. You can't do, like, I felt upset leaving that because I was like, you broke all movie rules.
The really cool thing about No Country for Old Men specifically and Coen Brothers' bleak phase in general, and I guess, I don't know if the credit should go to Cormac McCarthy because the movie follows the book, they did a really great job of setting up a lot of things that suggest there would be justice. They gave you all the bits and pieces of, don't worry, this story makes sense, there's a good guy. Look, we even gave him a nice cowboy hat, and here's a scene with him being nice
with him kissing his wife.
To his sweet wife, and then here's this monster. We've set up all these pieces, and not only does the good guy not win, he is killed by strangers in the most unsatisfying,
unceremonious,
off-screen movie death. And it's implied that
that's
maybe
point.
He just cheated on his wife also, like before all this happened, because he meets that girl at the pool and is like starting to flirt with her, and then that's it. So,
I think it's also strongly implied, obviously, because the Coens do nothing by accident, that that's the point. You're supposed to think about that now. And I do think Cormac McCarthy obviously deserves a lot of credit for being a depressing bastard, but I think it's unique in that the Coens, like, I really want to talk to them and be like, did someone hurt you and you lost all your faith? Because it was like a switchover. Like, after No Country, Burn After Reading, it's just the comedy version of No Country. It's saying, what if everything was fucked up because there is no justice and there is no system holding everything together, but it was funny this time.
Right. They spell out their thesis by the end of that movie when the guy describes everything that's happened, whomever he's talking to, not Rutger Hauer, but a guy who kind of looks like him, just like, so what did we learn from all this? And there's just nothing. There's no moral or lesson to it.
I feel like both of those movies have monologues at the end that explain something about the purpose. So they have the Tommy Lee Jones describing his dream where his dad is... It puts it in this context of man striving for survival across history. I do think those are similar to Game of Thrones to me in that they're specifically upsetting our expectations of like how narratives work that we've always liked to tell ourselves versus like how things actually happen, how humankind manages
to... Not all the time, but sometimes.
Right, how men manage to carry that fire forward is just like terrible shit happens. Sometimes the person who's best at killing everything and being a horrible monster gets to survive. I mean, I think Cormac McCarthy, like, that's a lot of the themes that he was working out. And I also think that Burn After Reading was sort of a meditation on when you read about how things actually happened in the U.S. government, this point in history when they were as powerful as any entity ever, like U.S. security forces, because they had better weapons. It was easier for them to abuse that power than ever before. And stuff happened accidentally all the time. Like, the U.S. almost ended the world because there was some miscommunication. A bear set off an alarm, and some guy took that as, like, Soviets are attacking, and they almost ended the world. It was, like, a lot of the most important and dangerous things that ever happened in the history of like international security are slapstick comedy events. And you know the movie Unforgiven, that's like one of my favorite movies. And I feel like that's the first really brilliant example of this, where it just explicitly ends with him saying deserves got nothing to do with it and killing like the sheriff, and you slowly realize that this guy who you've been rooting for the whole time is a bastard.
Yeah, well, I thought that's a great connection, because I really think, and many people have said, you know, Unforgiven's really the first neo-Western where Clint Eastwood was like, all that stuff that John Wayne and I made, like that mythos we created, I'm going to now place it in the real world. And the whole point is, no, you can't just shoot a bunch of guys and they just groan and fall over and nothing happens to you. It warps your soul. And that's super cool. And then I think Burn After Reading, the same way, did that with spy movies. I get the skewering the government part. I also thought it was just a structural study in doing, again, disappointment. Doing all the build-up maneuvers that any spy movie would do. A guy is following you in his car. A guy's building a secret contraption in his basement. There's all these tense moments, and it's never anything. That's the big joke always. It's just a sex thing for nothing.
Yeah.
The guy's just a divorce attorney. It didn't matter. Nothing matters. And that's the point. But it's not just nothing matters, I don't think, in the nihilistic way. It's also nothing matters. All the things you learned about watching movies, we don't have to do. And look, it's still a movie.
Right.
Which I love that about it. They're my favorites ever, so I feel weird saying this. But I even think, and maybe I'm just like full up because of Game of Thrones and Leftovers and stuff, I think even they go too far sometimes. Like, all great movies. Serious Man, Inside Llewyn Davis, both great. But the one I want to talk about is True Grit. Because True Grit, amazing movie. Obviously, they don't often do adaptations. Very faithful adaptation. The only real change they made was to add the explicit scene at the end where it says, and I grew up and I never saw him again. I tried to find him once. It turned out he was already dead. The end. It's this fun, light adventure about a girl and a guy who are the right people at the right time in each other's lives and help each other out. And there's a little father-daughter thing, and they save the day, and it ends. And then they just have a little epilogue where she's like, yeah, and I wanted to stay his friend, but he was like a horrible alcoholic. I tried to find him later, and he was dead. And I never married, and I never had another day of joy for the rest of my life.
And yes, I have one arm in the 1800s. You can imagine how that makes things difficult.
Right. Yeah. There are those little details in there, like the Indian that's hung and like stuff like that, where it jars you a little bit from the story, but you're too caught up in the narrative. But yeah, I do feel like Unforgiven did it as well as anything, because it made it entertaining while driving that point home that Westerns are nothing like you think. All the mythology that you've heard about history is total bullshit. It was just sick, old, dirty white guys killing each other in like really painful ways.
I felt like Serious Man was one of the most on the nose Coen nihilism things that they did. It's another one where they set up, here are the movie rules, here's this guy who's been picked on and kicked around his whole life, and he's finally gonna do, by the end of the movie, he does something for him, he does something, he compromises his morals a little bit, but is like, I'm gonna play by everyone's rules too. I'm gonna just do this thing because it's good for me. Good old win for a serious man who had to pay for the funeral of the guy who was sleeping with his wife.
Right.
And he's like, there, I did this thing, I took action, things are gonna happen, and then there a giant tornado is coming. Unrelated to what you were doing.
Whatever it is,
a huge black tornado.
Whether it's a real tornado or a symbol, you're fucked.
Yeah.
Like, clearly something horrible. That one to me almost felt like beyond nihilism. Like, actually they wanted to say, like the Book of Job or something. Like, let's do a movie about a guy who only gets fucked. Not random sequence events. He only gets fucked. Like, it really is. He has a rough time.
Did you say it was a retelling of the Book of Job?
No, I feel like it. It's a spiritual cousin to it.
Yeah.
I don't know if they had that in mind or if they've copped to that or anything.
Well, I'm sure.
Does he mention the Job in the movie? No,
probably I don't think so, but I know I've heard people make that
comparison.
Point.
Yeah.
Book of Job and a lot of Wizard of Oz comparisons.
Really?
Yeah, tornado. There's a long yellow pathway that the kid needs to go on to see that mysterious rabbi wizard guy.
Oh.
Talking
well, that's
got to
be intentional then.
Yeah.
We should talk about that on next podcast.
Lebowski. Just great.
No, like yeah.
If you play a serious man and Wizard of Oz at the same time,
nothing.
It becomes the big Lebowski.
Yeah.
It just,
That's what's funny is Lebowski was very of their classic phase where everything's fine and traditional movie rules. As weird as it seems, it's fairly traditional movie rules. Yet it's the only one that they actually have nihilist characters who are explicitly nihilists.
Well, they make fun of nihilists, yeah. So it's one of the funniest portrayals of nihilism, like just like yeah. taking that apart, that I've always assumed that when something seems nihilistic to me in their movies, I need to watch it again to like glom onto one monologue at the end that yeah. I can give it meaning through. But I think that is about a guy who embodies a philosophy completely and manages to survive on that philosophy, and that's as true to history as anything.
And meanwhile, Donnie dies for no reason.
You're right, there are traces, and
they do it in their final monologue, too, with Sam Elliott just talking about, didn't care for Donnie dying, or whatever he says, but he does mention, like, wish that didn't happen. There's no reason for that. It didn't.
Right.
And I'm God.
And now I'm remembering how in Miller Crossing, John Turturro begs for his life so convincingly, and the guy lets him live, and it turns out later he shouldn't have.
Yeah.
Mercy was not the right choice. So it goes all the way back, but it just seems like now they're much more like on the surface about, like the movie's about.
Right.
Yeah.
Bring it back to modern pop culture. It's like the Coens were 5 years ahead of Game of Thrones of the world.
Yeah.
So they were like, okay, now we can stop pretending to tell happy stories. My overall thoughts on the conversation would be that there's overall grimness, but there's always been overall grimness. The one thing that we have and sort of insist on that other cultures haven't is a happy ending, other than Sopranos, and I guess The Wire didn't really have a happy ending, but like Breaking Bad really did have a happy ending. Like,
I agree, and I felt hypocritical sitting for the earlier part of the conversation because Dan was saying how dark it is, and I believe on a previous podcast I argued that it should have been much, much darker, but I don't know if I feel that way anymore. Now that all these other shows have happened, I'm like, I could do with more happy endings. I'd be happy with some happy endings.
It's not as dark as a lot of other shows, but if you follow it out to its conclusion, as I've done, Walt Jr. is ruined.
Screwed. Right,
I mean, yeah. Like,
other shows would show that. This show at least cut it off, so they're like, hey, if you want to be dumb, you can assume that Jesse adopts that kid and it works out. Obviously, that doesn't happen. But you can think that if you want.
I do feel like at any other time, 50 years from now, in China, when they're pouring over these podcasts, Breaking Bad will seem like a serious movie in the same way that like we look back and see serious novels that just happened to have the hero get his way completely at the end. That would at least be strange if in a Russian novel the hero who had been doing the wrong thing and harming people all along, suddenly it was like, ah, but he's like sort of a Christ figure when you think about
it. And then I inherited all my uncle's rubles.
Right.
Happily.
Just wanted to hear Michael's Russian accent.
It's his McConaughey, too.
Hey guys, we are once again sponsored this week by lynda.com, lynda.com, which helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with easy to follow video tutorials. This is what learning on the internet should be like. They have over 2,400 courses taught by industry experts, and they're adding more every week. And they work directly with software companies to provide timely training, often the same day new versions of releases hit market, so you're always up to speed. So there's like no reason to take Apple Genius courses or whatever those courses are that they offer at the back of the Apple store. And once again, I've worked out a deal with lynda.com to provide you with a special offer to access the entire library free for 7 days. Visit lynda.com, that's lynda.com/cracked, to start your 7-day free trial. That's lynda.com/cracked. I think while movies and TV sort of embraced the darkness, I feel like music has gone the other way and has been like, we're all getting blacked out. Fuck it. Yeah.
No, and like the big band now is called Fun. And all the songs are, we're always going to be young. Nothing. It's all fine.
But like, no, that song there's, in the We Are Young song, there's a casual bit of spousal abuse. Nice. I mean, he does.
That's
mention,
actually a Cheers homage.
He mentions giving her scars and is still like, but tonight's about us, baby.
But tonight we're
sorry,
drinking. So
I think that there is the acknowledgement that things aren't great, and not just economic. I do think that, like, from a overall like existential perspective, anybody who's like really making art in the Western world in the modern day has to acknowledge, oh my God, look at all the horrible shit that like has happened that we can't ignore. But music has found a way to, you know, acknowledge that reality by totally focusing on like how we escape that
right.
reality.
Well, it's like we were talking about everything shifts around, right? Like it's interesting to me that, and of course there's always segmentedness and so it's not everywhere the same. But like I feel like in the 60s, 70s, music was, or a much higher percentage of the music, they felt like, I'm Bob Dylan, it's my job to like say true stuff and be important. And movies, there have been periods where movies felt, it's the Depression, so our job is just to be escapist and cheer people up. And I don't know what the forces are per se, but it's just so interesting that it could shift so much. Whereas today it's like, it's TV's job to be important. It's music's job to cheer you up because the world is depressing. It's like it just goes around and around yeah. what you use your media for.
It's this is where I'm a hypocrite because I was earlier complaining that I don't want any more sad TV because I'm already sad and just do something nice. And I had never even connected these two thoughts, but for months now, I've just hated music on the radio because I feel like music is so soft right now and it has absolutely no edge. Like if you're listening to K-Rock, which is just my barometer mm-hmm. in Los Angeles for here is the music that's happening right now. This is just old man syndrome. It all sounds the same to me and it all sounds soft and toothless. Yeah. Is this the first time in music history where no one is disruptive? No one is punk. No one is rap trying to break rules. No one is...
Or just at least a very
least
small
like
percentage.
Pretending yeah. to be disruptive. Right, like, yeah. there's no Kurt Cobain figures right now who is like, I'm reacting to your thing, and I'm proving that I can make music with this thing, too.
Right.
And there's no punk doing this, like...
And I'm sure there's people's
sloppy,
favorite
dirty.
Artists out there that are doing that. But in a general sense, yeah, I completely
In general sense,
agree.
It seems like everyone... No, everyone's allowed to make music. No one needs yeah. to struggle or rebel against it. What are eighth graders listening to
in, to piss
to,
their parents
to get,
off?
To make their parents yeah. mad?
The top 40, there used to be a lot of songs about heartache and, mm-hmm. you know, you'd sneak a Pearl Jam song in there about a school shooting or like something right. like relevant to the news. And now it really seems to be like the only controversial songs are like, we're talking about partying and we acknowledge that people right. are doing Molly. So yeah. that seems to be the scene. I do want to acknowledge that there's great rap music that's not just like party rap, like Kendrick Lamar
yeah,
just released a great album that's soaked in the atmosphere of his upbringing
Very
and
good.
Like Compton. But just by and large, the stuff on the top 40 radio.
Who the fuck is Iggy Azalea?
She's an Australian rapper who sounds like Nicki Minaj and looks like a Barbie doll. And
All right.
I believe
I like the
her.
Nicki Minaj part.
I believe her. Rhymes are written by T.I. The song was the number one song on the radio is Fancy now.
And she is also featured on the number two song.
Yes. Which both of those I featured on this podcast.
Mm, you're ahead of your time.
Good
I'm,
songs.
I'm just old.
There is some old manism, but there's also like, you don't see top 40 music that acknowledges even like heartache that much.
Right.
Like there's not like that many breakup songs.
Number
it's like,
three song is Summer.
Yeah.
Number five is Ain't It Fun?
Right, yeah. So we're looking at the top 40. This is great.
Birthday turned so, down for what? Not a bad thing.
Wow. Yeah, so we're looking
so
at the
cheerful.
Top 40, and it's all...
There you go. Love Runs Out, number 17. You got to go down to 17 to find one that's like
and
my heart
you
is
also
broken.
Have All of Me by John Legend, but that's really just like... I don't want to alienate all our female listeners, but it's... Just a Hallmark card to his wife. It's very loving. Dark Horse seems like it could be dark, but I'm pretty sure she just says, are you ready yeah. for ready for a dark horse?
That's another thing is music. I think we have almost the least focus on lyrics of any era of music, where a lot of the songs are just saying, like, there was a dance, there were objects there. Like, that's all the content
yeah.
that the lyrics elucidate.
And I'm not asking for a return to Bob Dylan. Like, I liked Bob Dylan growing up. He's a great writer and a really fascinating figure, but that time has passed, and, like, Radiohead made a great album, Kid A, with five words, you know?
Right,
like,
I was
going
to say,
no one's
listening to Radiohead lyrics and going, like, I have to protest tomorrow.
Yeah. I do want to come back to something, because the old man thing is probably...
I want to talk about old man.
Old man thing is probably true of me specifically when I listen to the radio and I end up just going back to my old CDs when it was real, you know? But separate from my own tastes, I do genuinely feel like there needs to be someone scary out there for kids to rebel. I mean, that was important to me, whether it was listening to punk for the first time, or I remember my parents being terrified of Eminem when I was a kid, and everyone was terrified. He was like a news story. Everyone watch out for this Eminem. I think that's formative to have that kind of, like, mm-hmm. something that is a disruptive presence that can be yours. That can be the first thing that is like, my parents don't like this, and I really do, and this is important to me.
Can we just go through the top five there real quick while acknowledging that Happy was the song
one
of the
them
summer?
Is happy.
Number one song is Fancy, which I now realize
I'm so
I know
fancy
only because I watched Weird Al's parody
Handy.
Of it today. He did Handy.
I'm just realizing that too, that's
what
a
he
real
was
song.
Talking
yeah.
about. Yeah.
Problem is actually they're talking about leaving somebody, but it's mm-hmm. like one of those triumphant I got one less problem without you.
Yeah.
Summer, I have no idea what that's about.
Sounds pleasant, though.
Yeah.
No, I know that song, and it's just him talking about a pleasant evening in the summer. Am I wrong? I bet you're not, Nico
yeah.
and Vince.
Nico and Vince, I think I know.
Ain't it fun? Sure is. I bet it is, Paramore. Oh. Magic! Rude. So maybe they're bringing some of the darkness
to
light.
Darkness,
Turn Down for What, the other song of the summer that is just fucking weird going all night,
Let's
you guys.
Let's not care yeah. about reality.
Yes, exactly.
Let's listen to this noise in my yeah. ear. I like it.
And I think it's okay. It's just interesting. Like, I'm not blaming it. I actually like a lot of those songs.
It's just interesting.
It's
yeah.
just interesting that at a time when we're going so dark and when it seems like the natural direction to go would be like, man, there is a lot of awful shit in the world that we know about and can't not know about, that music has just gone in this completely opposite direction.
Is Eddie Vedder sick or something?
No, well, he just had an album come out.
It's just
not
old,
too long
man.
Ago.
It's just old. Rap is my favorite type of music. I've never liked anything that was like issue rap or like people mm-hmm. being like, man, we've got to have consciousness. But like at the same time, when Nas burst on the scene, he was rapping about shit he saw in mm-hmm. the streets of his neighborhood.
Still
and, like,
built
feeling,
up mythologically. I mean, still like...
Yeah, but like feeling like a black rat trapped. That's
a
pretty...
A little black rat's trapped.
That's... almost as good as your yeah. McConaughey.
A strange thing about rap, because I like the conscious rap. I like nerdcore rap a whole lot, and I like everyone on the Rhymesayers label, and they do a lot of issue stuff, but it's still, even the most indie of indie rap artists, they almost all, to a person, still have one track that is like, all right, here's my I'm super great, my dick's the best, and I have lots of money rap. We haven't shaken that from rap yet, that here's an entire rap about how much I love my kids and how my divorce from my wife was difficult. But before we get into that, let me just tell you how great I am at basketball and shooting.
Right. Whatever the guy's name is who sang that song, I Wish I Was a Little Bit Taller. I mm-hmm. bet his whole album, other than that, was like really like hardcore yeah. like shit about there being too much violence.
Skee-Lo.
There you yeah. go.
I feel like the old man conversation ties into everything, though, not just music or like... I want to ask you guys if this resonates for you. Two horrible observations. The first being that I recently watched Antichrist, Lars von Trier movie with my girlfriend, and it is very, very dark and ends with like horrible genital mutilation, essentially.
Doesn't just end with it.
Very well done. Yeah, it's like, I mean, like the
liberally
last third
sprinkled
of it.
Throughout.
Yeah. Well, he's been making terrifying movies for
and
a
I,
while, yeah.
Yeah, fine. And I knew that going in. All I can say is, she was fine, by the way. I was watching through like my fingers, you know, mm-hmm. interlaced fingers, couldn't watch. And I haven't seen the really bad part. I haven't seen. I closed my eyes. Yeah. I didn't see it. That's crazy to me because 18-year-old me was forwarding Faces of Death videos to his friends as pranks in college. You know what yeah. I mean? Like, I felt so desensitized. And I think it's just an aspect of living and now, like, I don't know someone that this has happened to, like Antichrist, but I know people that have had horrible things happen to them and more real horrible things have happened to me. And stuff just seems more real. But I feel like that must be true of all the people working on Game of Thrones, too. So it's like, I wonder if they leave set and are just really sad.
That is interesting. If the people who work on it have to go home and tell their wife, yeah, I had to make this effect where this right. wonderful, beautiful hero character who everyone loved and followed, I had to make it look like there was blood coming right out of his eyes because he's getting his skull crushed by
right, and like, what about
monster.
True Detective? That is just not a good extra job. The day where they shot the tape of all the guys with robes and antlers gathering around a little girl in the woods. Yeah. Who wants that acting gig?
I mean, literally everyone in Los Angeles.
Right. Everyone would kill for that role.
The ending of True Detective really bugged me because they set up so much in that show. They make it a mystery show. This guy who's got green hair. Mm-hmm. We keep seeing Carcosa everywhere. There's all these
spirals,
symbols. Yellow King, all this stuff. Why? Oh, because he's crazy.
Is Carcosa.
What is that?
What
mean?
Is it?
It's just a word he likes because he's crazy.
Right.
Why does he talk in all those different voices? Because right. He's nuts. I don't know.
At least
isn't that spooky?
At least in Game of Thrones, when you're screaming why through your hands,
you actually know why what happened. You're just unhappy.
Right. And they can be like, oh, because this right. very thing happened in history.
Well, it's like you were saying, Game of Thrones, I feel like, at least to its credit, very upfront and often reminds you, this show is a series of chess pieces. Whoever plays the best and is lucky, in some cases, will win and everyone else will die. You know that all the time. But I feel very much like, Dan, like, True Detective was a great character study. And then he was like, I also want to squeeze in a mystery. And then there wasn't room for it. So at the end, he's like, there wasn't a mystery. It yeah. was just a pet. I mean, they thought it was a pedophile at the beginning, and then it was.
Why did the girl say that guy had green hair? He was painting a house, and he got paint in his... Did I forget to say that there was a house painter? He was painting a house, and he got green yeah. in his hair. He washed it out as soon as he got home.
Bullshit, True Detective.
Way to go, Nick Pizza Latte.
Another novelist. Who yeah. Novelist Ooh, turned pizza TV latte. Writer. Yeah.
Pizza lattes latte. After this? Pizza yeah. latte?
That sounds delicious.
It does.
The Fargo adaptation, I guess, ended somewhat optimistically, and there's humor in that show, but...
Oh, I still got one episode left.
There's still... All right,
don't
I won't spoil it.
No, you can for the good of the people if it's a good point.
I'll go as far as to say that there's not really character justice. The things that are set up do not pay off the way that you want them to, and it was very...
Well, also, I mean, the movie Fargo body count is like one or two people, three? Mm-hmm. No, maybe four by the end, but I'm watching the whole movie in my head right
yeah,
but
they're...
The point being, the show... To me, it's weird. It's like a double adaptation. The show, to me, seems like an adaptation of Fargo and just Anton Chigurh from
yeah.
No Country is also here. It kind of gets to an action movie point mm-hmm. at some points. The body count is just so high in that show.
The movie is still my favorite Coen Brothers movie. I feel stupid saying that because it's also probably their happiest ending, but I feel like the reason is because it builds to a crescendo. I feel like there's portraying a movie in which there's a bleakness and hopelessness that matches what the universe is really like, but you're still watching a movie. You want to see the big thing happen at the end uh-huh. where you're like, oh shit, there's somebody getting put into a wood chipper. Yeah. Like, that's the most remarkable image I've ever seen yeah. in a movie, and that is the climax. You know, they line those up.
But it's not like No Country, because the point of the movie is also, you know, very much about, look how these normal people who are nothing special can ultimately win against the monsters. She's just a hardworking, nice person. Yeah. And then, I don't know, I thought,
but
you're saying it's happy.
Ultimately good. They are younger versions of the farming couple from American Gothic.
Yeah, like, I just love, like, I love the Fargo ending, and I think of it as very
it's
uplifting.
Probably
simply
their most optimistic ending yeah. with them just
other than maybe
there,
Raising Arizona.
They say we're okay or we're doing all right.
Yeah, the fact
like
that, yeah, that line, and I also love, and it was such a nice day too. Or what I got from it at the time was just, horrible shit happens, and the only appropriate response is, that's a shame. Why'd you do that? Yeah. We're all trying to get along over here. And I don't feel like in No Country for Old Men, that's the solution. You're supposed to fight Anton Chigurh.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's like, that's evolved. But it's also funny to, like, take a human being, which we have to remind ourselves the Coen brothers are, and say, like, over the course of your 30 years making movies, all your thoughts better have stayed yeah. consistent.
Well, it seems that Sheriff Ed Bell in No Country for Old mm-hmm. Men is, like, the graduated version of Frances McDormand from Fargo. I mean, you
oh,
got
yeah.
this cop
That's
who's
great, yeah.
chasing the bad guy and tracking them down and doing the right thing and winning and ending it talking to her spouse saying, we're okay, right? We're not doing too bad.
We're doing good, you
we're
know.
We're doing good, you know?
We're doing
yeah.
real good.
And then fast forward to Tommy Lee Jones, who's the closest analog as far as good cop goes, and his resolution, him talking to his spouse at the end is, I don't think I can do this. I don't think I'm cut out for this. This country sure isn't
I'm
for old
scared.
Men. I imagine he retires from the force
Shortly thereafter. Yeah, of course. Yeah, you got to assume.
We had an article that was about how that movie was about the evils of retirement.
As soon as you quit your job, you're done?
You're done, yeah. As soon as you step away from the thing you're doing. And like that depiction of his father, when he goes to visit his father, the retired sheriff, mm-hmm. and he's like fly covered
filthy
and in
house.
This like filthy cats. House with like nothing yeah. working. Because you're right that both of those movies have really sympathetic police characters who face sort of blank evil violence. Like there's something similar about Sugar and Peter
Stormare.
Is that really how you pronounce it? Stormare?
Stormare, yeah.
Stormare is Stormare. Character in Fargo.
Wait, is that Unguent guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
just
blank-eyed cold sociopaths.
Alien,
yeah. Doesn't understand the value of human life in even the basic sense.
And she...
Very good villain.
She has a moment at the end where she's like, why did you do that?
Yeah, like, it was such a nice day.
Talk to him when he's in the car. She hasn't yet clicked for her that he can exist in the same world as her.
Right.
And I think she realizes it's her last opportunity probably to get that answer out of him. She'll only have him in her care right now.
Right. I do think there's a way to read the ending as slightly darker if you realize that she'll never be able to sort of reconcile that guy's existence with the world that she chooses to live in. And she has to go home and like reassure herself, be like, we're going to be all right, right, hon? And she has this painter husband who
maybe
just like,
I just want to
like,
believe
yeah, sure,
happy,
I paint ducks.
Right, but I just can't believe that they would choose to make her pregnant and he wins the 2-cent stamp and it's supposed to be depressing. Or I don't know. I feel like there's enough clues in there that you're supposed to think they are doing all right.
I don't know. Now that Jack's got it in my ear, I can't not think about she's not going to sleep that night. She's going to stay up and still try to figure out, why did this blonde freak do all these things? What was the point of all this?
Because if I remember correctly, then when she asks him why he does stuff, he didn't give her a very eloquent answer.
He doesn't say anything. I don't think he speaks.
I know.
Yeah. And that's the thing, that if she's her and she's a detective whose job it is to find answers, that'll just drive her crazy forever. And the answer that she will eventually land on is that some people are monsters and you can't even tell them apart from the other people. And they exist in this world. This is your 9/11. You've existed your whole life thinking things were one way. Mm-hmm. And now we've just introduced this bit of chaos and it's real and it's everywhere.
Right. And I also think Fargo takes more care than most movies with monsters in them. I think that's probably very intentional, very true, because of the menagerie of monsters in Fargo, no two are alike, and it's very clear that that excited them to be like, oh, look, William H. Macy is going to ruin everything just out of being pathetic. This guy's going to ruin everything out of being a sociopath. This guy's going to ruin everything out of being like a little shitty, greedy weasel. Mm-hmm. This guy is an old man who shows no one love and hoards all his money. He's also going to ruin everything. All the normal people, you know, any of them, for any given reason, could turn out to be a horrible monster.
Right.
He's fleeing. Yeah. He's fleeing the interview.
When Steve Buscemi is talking to that prostitute and says, little of the old in and out.
My acting teacher in college was that prostitute.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I think my favorite is when, it's going to get pretty blue on this podcast, when Shep comes rips Steve Buscemi out of the bed. And he's like, Shep, come on, I'm fucking this girl.
No, I was banging that girl.
I was banging that girl. It's like, he didn't see.
Oh, Shep. Shep's scary, too. Jeez. Yeah. Anyway, that's all the Coen Brothers movies.
What the fuck are we going to call this episode? Coen Brothers movies in darkness?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I call it, can you believe that Smith House has over 100 taps? Yeah. Smith House bar.
Blasting top 40 music all the time.
Free Wi-Fi, if you can believe that much. And outlets right in the
Smithhouse.
Bar.
Smithhouse.com, one word. I don't even know if that's true.
All right. Hope you enjoyed that sort of strange episode. We usually put some thoughts down in an email, send them around to our guests. They'll send me some thoughts or just have them in their head the old-fashioned way. But there's usually more of a roadmap. This time we just kind of sat down and talked it out. Hope it worked for you guys. A few thoughts I had listening back to what we talked about. First of all, on music, there's tons of great hip-hop that we didn't mention that suggest plenty of terrible behaviors for kids to emulate during their rebellious phase. Chicago is just exploding with young, talented artists like Chance and Hurt Everybody, who you're hearing in this episode. We'll talk about on footnotes. But
we were talking about the top 40, and there really does seem to be something going on there, some sort of willful self-distraction and like kind of soothing that everything's great. Everything is awesome. Happy. There was just a song named Happy. One particularly weird trend last year, maybe I'm related, but I thought was worth bringing up, is that 2013 was the first year in the 55-year history of Billboard charts that there wasn't a single black artist with a number one hit. I mentioned Iggy Azalea, a blonde Australian who raps exactly like Nicki Minaj. Like, it's the most normal thing in the world, but Nicki Minaj is probably the most talented female rapper of all time, and she's never had a number one hit, but you give a white girl a catchy Nicki Minaj song, and it's been number one for a month, and it's the song of the summer. And last year's song of the summer was Miley Cyrus performing a Rihanna song. So as much as we sounded like old men complaining about top 40 music, I do feel like something's changed there with what we let ourselves believe, I guess, and what we'll let other people get away with in our popular music. And then on the movies and TV shows that we talked about, I feel less and less like Coen Brothers and Game of Thrones are being nihilists when they make horrible shit happen in their movies that attacks our expectations that good guys and bad guys get what they deserve. I wonder if it's not just realism. When you think about it, it's kind of strange that we'd decided up to this point in history that all movies should take place in a world where karma magically intervenes on behalf of people who live by the golden rule. We even had a style of movie called realism. Rocky I was a famous realist movie, but that version of realism just meant that characters were kind of superficially ugly and worked blue-collar jobs. But he still wins a moral victory in the end, and everyone's cheering for him, and he becomes the people's champ in the sequels. But that's not how reality actually works. For instance, Sylvester Stallone stole the story for Rocky from a fight he saw where a white, kind of no-talent boxer named Chuck Wepner took Muhammad Ali the distance in what was supposed to be a quick knockout. And that guy, Chuck Wepner, the real Rocky, went on to a career forging Muhammad Ali autographs on memorabilia from that fight, getting arrested by the FBI for doing that. But mostly his career consisted of claiming Sylvester Stallone stole his story for the most famous movie of the 80s and never gave him a penny, which was probably true, but he wasn't a super bright guy. That's a detail of Rocky's personality that sort of fades to the background in the sequels. And people like that get pushed around in the real world. They don't get what they deserve. So there's a way in which the answer to our question in this episode, which I guess was, why are you so dark, Game of Thrones? Is because every other movie you've ever liked or that you consider not dark is sort of lying to you. We've lived our lives with stories in which the same good behaviors and moral structures are rewarded. And the truth is, the underdog doesn't win moral victories, anything short of outright victory, and he gets his head squished like a grape, or he gets his life story stolen without receiving a dime until he's forced into forging Apollo Creed's signature to make money. All right, on to footnotes. We listened to Hella Lightning, Hella Swords by Heard Everybody, three rapper producers out of Chicago. Found out about them on a recent episode of Get Up On This with Jensen Karp, which is still a great podcast you should be listening to. And I've been listening to nothing but Hurt Everybody since I found out about them. Just sort of like Chance, the Chicago rapper we've listened to on past episodes, but with moodier production that kind of changes direction a lot. It's sort of like, reminds me of the medley at the end of Abbey Road, the Beatles album. They just released a new EP called the Hurt Everybody EP that you can download for free on hurteverybody.com. This song's from back in February. We'll check out some of the songs from the EP on future episodes, I'm sure, but I wanted to feature something from Chicago on this episode since Chicago is both the scariest city in America for like 10 years running to live in. It's got murder rate higher than Iraq at the height of the war over there. There's a great This American Life episode that takes you inside one of the schools there and what it's like to be a kid growing up there. And they also happen to be making the most exciting hip-hop music, or just the most exciting music of any city right now, maybe ever. I don't know. Anyways, none of it's going to hit the top 40. We went into ads on a song called Memories That You Call from an electronic music duo named Odessa, spelled O-D-E-S-Z-A. It's off of an upcoming album, In Return, and features vocals by Monsoon Siren, an Indian dude with a real pretty voice. Thanks, Hype Machine. And we closed out and are going to ride out on James Blake, who we've heard from before in his song Retrograde, which was all over the trailer and pilot episode for The Leftovers, which Daniel talked about and which I finally watched last night. And it was my favorite pilot episode of anything ever. Just one thing after another that I'm a sucker for. Not the teenagers choking each other and crying and J&O. That's not my thing. But yeah, lots of just really cool, weird, mysterious stuff. So I guess here we go again. I'm going to be bummed out on Sundays for a while. Also, weirdly, it uses the sort of surround sound audio logo for THX, and I feel like the Hurt Everybody song I chose is using the default Nokia ringtone. I did not do that on purpose, but apparently that's another thing I'm a sucker for. Music that uses ambient noise from my everyday life that I normally find annoying. Anyways, thank you for listening. Please rate and review us on iTunes. Use the word constabulary in your positive review of us, and I'll know it was you. We are off next week, back the week after with more podcast. I will talk to you then.
So show me why you're strong. Ignore everybody else. We're alone now. So show me why you're strong. Ignore everybody else. We're alone now. Suddenly I'm hidden. It's this darkness of the dawn. And your friends are gone. And your friends won't come. So show me where you fit. So show me where you fit. So show me why you're strong. Ignore everybody else. We're alone now.
Hey guys, one more time, I just want to thank Lynda.com for sponsoring this episode. Lynda.com, L-Y-N-D-A, offers over 2,400 courses that can teach you about anything from the latest Microsoft Office update, Adobe Creative Cloud, Final Cut Pro, Logic Pro, anything, you name it. It's like getting a college course in exactly what you want. And once again, I've worked out a deal with Lynda.com to provide you with a special offer to access the entire library free for 7 days. Visit lynda.com/crack to start your 7-day free trial. That's lynda.com/cracked.